for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In 1979, Bob Edwards became the host of NPR's Morning Edition, a post he held for nearly 25 years. Now, in his new memoir, titled A Voice in the Box, Edwards writes about his more than 30,000 interviews, why he left NPR, and what it's like to be a satellite radio pioneer. Bob Edwards joins me in the studio. I just wish I had your voice.
But that would be redundant. We already have one of those.
I'd love to have your voice, Bob. It's great. I've already got people writing in. Here's a comment from Liz on Facebook. There just is no other that can take his place, and my morning coffee hasn't been the same.
Wow.
So nice to have you here, Bob.
You should go decaf, maybe.
Yeah, right. Maybe. Some change. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. I understand you were named after a pirate.
Robert Edwards served the crown by removing the treasure of Spanish ships along the East Coast. Yes, and as a reward, was given property in Lower Manhattan. And I don't know, it was supposed to fall to various heirs of Robert Edwards. And there's an organization called Edwards Heirs. And many people named Edwards have been defrauded by lawyers who say that property is rightfully Edwards and does not belong to Trinity Church and the New York Stock Exchange and the other. And people have actually given money to this. This goes on today. My grandfather knew all about this.
But, you know, it's so interesting because your parents were such frugal people.
They were indeed. And to this day, I squeeze the toothpaste from the bottom up. I you know, use the bar of soap till it's a bubble.
Absolutely.
Because they were Depression people, and
exactly,
that's how they trained me.
And so you graduated from high school in 1965, then registered for the draft. And then what happened?
Well, I had to work my way through college. We were poor folk, and it was the only way I could do it was go to night school. And I did that for 4 years, nights, weekends, summers, working full-time, knocking on doors of radio stations, begging to join the staff. And finally, my senior year, it worked. I got on the radio, my first job.
But, you know, I must say, I loved radio from the time I was a little girl, but never occurred to me that I could be part of that process.
Because it was a guy thing then.
Yeah, yeah, it was a guy thing, but you saw yourself inside
the
box. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, age three, age four, that's all I ever wanted to do. That's why the title of the book, I thought, A Voice in the Box. I wanted to be one of those voices in the box, the big, big, big radio in our living room.
So tell me about that first job.
Little tiny radio station, 1570 on the dial, 1,000 watts, only a daytimer, shut down when the sun went down. It's you know, light bulbs have more power than that station had. But one of those places where you did everything, you know, you did the news, you spun records, went out and tried to sell commercial time.
Huh.
Fix the plumbing, sweep the floors.
How many people were there?
Four or five.
Four or five.
Uh-huh. There was we never saw the manager. Never saw the sales guy. You know, rarely had a paying ad. It was all trade-outs. the manager and the sales manager were getting carpeting and TVs, and I don't know, and we were reading the commercials, but there was no cash.
So what was the programming?
The world's most beautiful music. That's how I sounded.
I bet you
sounded. I mean, Sinatra was up-tempo for us. It was barely above dentist office and elevators.
And so you had at WHEL 1570 in Albany.
New Albany.
New Albany, Indiana.
Right.
And here he is.
My name is Bob Edwards. Thanking you very much for all the kindnesses that you've given me over the year. I'll be leaving now, joining the Army, I presume.
I presume, because they were drafting Marines at the time, too, so I didn't know if I was going to be
drafted.
Drafting
Marines at the time.
Oh, it was bad. They were still recovering from Tet in 68, and they were taking any warm body. I'm telling you, the guy in front of me in line had a pin in his hip and brought his x-rays. They drafted him. That's how bad it was in 69. I knew there was no way I was getting out of this deal.
So what happened?
I was drafted. I went off to Fort Knox for basic, made training films in Georgia, and then became the 6 o'clock TV anchorman in Seoul, Korea. I told them, this is the one time not to be modest about yourself, because you're saving your life, right? I didn't want to be in the infantry. I told them I was Walter Cronkite. They would be missing out if they didn't make me a broadcaster. And it worked.
It worked. Yeah. And how did you like television as opposed to radio?
I hate it. Still.
Yeah.
You know, when I go just to be interviewed on a television program, I'm nervous, upset, worried about what I look like.
Yeah.
How do I
it's
look in this
very
set?
Very different.
You know, everything is phony. It's a phony bookcase behind me. What is this? Phony flowers on the table. I hate it. Just love radio. Crazy about radio. Just keep me in a radio studio.
It's mind to mind.
It goes right to the head, yes. And the pictures are perfect because the listener is forming those pictures.
Exactly.
We're helping. We're helping form them.
You bet.
But the listener is making his own pictures, and it's perfect.
You came to the American University.
Right out of the
here
Army.
Here,
yeah.
In 1971, mm-hmm. for graduate school in journalism. Ed Bliss became someone so important to you.
Just made my career. Everything, all good things come from my friendship with Ed Bliss. And his mentoring, and he could teach writing. He had never been on the air himself, but he could teach writing, and that's the most important thing.
Writing,
you get writing
for broadcast.
Right. You get to writing down, you can get everything else somewhere else. But, and he was just a kind friend. He was a sweetheart, a very sweet, gentle man, until you handed in your copy.
And then
he was Attila the Hun.
Yeah.
Oh,
then
he,
red pen all
oh, he had
the way
no mercy.
Yeah.
No mercy. He would have girls in tears and tell them they needed to change their major and get out of the business.
Girls were in that class?
And some of them went on to be, you know, one of them I know became the Capitol Hill correspondent for UPI, but he was telling her back then, get out of the business. But they learned. You see, it was tough love. You know, he thought, you know, there was no small mistake. Every mistake was critical. I once put two T's at the end of Connecticut, and he said, "Oh, Bob." That's the way he would do it. You know, "Oh, Bob, I thought you knew better."
Yeah,
you know, it was
exactly.
Like a poison dart to
exactly.
the heart. You know, I hurt Dad. This is my surrogate father here.
So, how long were you with him? How did he help?
We were pals
career?
For 30 years, and I would check in with him. And some of the words I wrote in this book he objected to and told me so. And they remain in the book today, I'm sorry to say. But, you know, for 30 years until the day he died. And he was turning out books. He had a book in his typewriter, and it was, in fact, a typewriter.
Wow.
On the day he died.
Wow.
I wish he could have finished that, because it was about the glory years at CBS News, and he was part of that.
Being of course, Roger Mudd has.
Yeah.
Also written a book about the glory years
about
at
the
CBS.
Washington Bureau.
Yeah,
yeah,
true.
Yeah, the place to be, he called it, and that
the
was
place
the place to
be.
And I was
so,
right across the street.
How did you end up working for NPR?
I was with the Mutual Broadcasting System, and the now defunct network that served little stations like WHEL. And I was a big union guy, still am. And they threw me out of there because they didn't like union people. They were trying to bust the union at Mutual. And so at the end of 73, I was out of work, and I picked up the phone book and called everything with the word radio in its name. I think I got to radio repair and radiology and called this thing called National Public Radio. I'd never heard of it.
Never heard of it.
Well, it was not yet 3 years old.
Right.
And I called up, and they said, yeah, come on down. It was that kind of place in the
earliest
days.
How many people were at NPR at the time?
Total 80 or so.
Yeah.
And I mean 80 doing station relations and doing other stuff, not on the air broadcasting.
Trying to build a network.
We knew each other so well. We knew the names of other people's children that worked there. That's how close we were in this tiny little place, a whisper of a place. They did have a Peabody for the first year of All Things Considered, because it was just so innovative and not like anything had ever been on the radio before. But the audience was maybe a million, maybe. And each day, it was a 90-minute program then, it came on at 5, and we would start in the morning with a blank board. Nothing. And by 5 o'clock, we had to fill 90 minutes. And the ways we did that were experimental, bold. You could get away with trying anything because we had no resources.
Bob Edwards. He's the host of The Bob Edwards Show on Sirius XM Radio and Bob Edwards Weekend, distributed to public radio stations. His book, A Voice in the Box. Voice you know very well, that of Bob Edwards. He's here in the studio with me. His new book is titled A Voice in the Box, My Life in Radio. He's a lifelong lover of radio. His program is now on Sirius XM Radio and Bob Edwards Weekend, which is on public radio stations around the country, including this one. I think you're on at 3 o'clock on Sunday, and I'm on at 2 o'clock on Sunday. So,
well, I've got the best lead-in, don't I?
Together at last. Tell me about what you started doing before you got to ATC, All Things Considered, at NPR.
I was the newscaster for 6 months. They only did 4 newscasts a day, and I
4.
Did them all. Yeah, they did one rollover of All Things Considered, so they repeated it for the West Coast, like old-time radio. And so there were 2 newscasts in All Things Considered at that time. So with the rollover, that made 4. So I'd be the only one in the shop. Everyone else would go home because they wouldn't update. They wouldn't update the program.
So then...
Now it's completely different. It's
so
crazy.
Then you became host.
Right, in August of 04, no, 74, just in time to do the talk up to Nixon's resignation speech. Oh, gosh, was I trembling when I gave that. I had mic fright. in the early days. Yeah, I had really bad mic fright.
You and me both.
And I would lose my breath when I
was
reading something important.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, this is history.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, thank goodness those days are over.
So hosting that program, you also partnered with Susan Stamper.
Wow, did I ever, and learned so much, so much. I have a whole chapter on Susan because I was going to school on her. At first, I thought, you know, who is this person? Oh, my gosh, what is she doing on the radio? And I didn't get it that she was a natural in radio. Listeners loved her.
Absolutely.
She was radio magic.
Yeah.
And it took me a little while to get that through my thick head.
What was it that...
Oh, because I was so Edward R. Murrow. I was so strict, so, you know,
there
is decorum at the microphone.
Yeah,
I was straight. I call myself Mr. Prig. Yeah, and I didn't get it. I so loved radio and didn't get it. You know, what's the matter? And Susan helped me get it. She also taught me how to do an interview, and not by instruction, just by my observing her, that the questions had to sustain. It wasn't like getting sound bites for a newscast, that the questions also had to be as entertaining as hopefully the answers would be.
Let's hear a little bit.
By the time I got there, year number three.
Yes.
I mean, this was the Susan Stamberg Show.
Oh, I don't know about that, but let me tell your listeners what it was like when you walked in that studio. First of all, a god. You were a blonde god, tall, blonde, handsome. And you'd sit down in your black turtleneck sweater. You don't even remember this, I bet you. In a big room much like this one. And there was no separate place for you. Hired to be the newscaster do your maybe 10-minute newscast or so. So Waters and I, or whoever it was I was working with at that point, had to sit quietly, not even burp, for 10 minutes while you did your little thing. And then you would take up your papers, leave, and we could talk once again. Because all the mics, well, your mic was on, so anything that we did near you would get out on the air. But you did commend yourself very well, I must say you did. Rather well in coming in there, and I think you did it for 2 days before they made you my co-host. It was a meteoric ride.
You had fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was total fun. That's the big difference in the beginning. You're in a tiny little organization, and there are no rules, and you can have fun. There are also no resources, which is why you can have fun. We would do contests. We would do... we had to come up with stuff to fill the program. We would say, all right, tell us where you get the best hamburger in America. And people would inundate us with cards and letters.
Of course.
And that would be good for 10 minutes.
That's great. That's great.
We had interviews with dulcimer makers. We had the audio of a quilting bee. This was all things considered in the early days. But there would also be some brilliant piece of journalism
you
in
bet.
The middle of it.
Like you bet.
Ira Flato was a reporter then, Linda Wertheimer, Barbara Newman, Josh Darsa, Bob Zelnick was covering the legal side. Judy Miller was a freelancer with us later to get herself in trouble with the New York
Times.
The
New York Times. And then you, after Morning Edition had gone on the air and flopped,
oh, yeah.
You became
Well, it didn't go
host.
On the air. That was the important thing.
Well,
it was
we
a closed
heard
circuit.
It. Yeah, exactly.
They did a pilot, and the stations heard it.
Right.
And it was an abomination. It was terrible.
Why do you think it was so bad?
The fellow they hired to run it came from a local station, had been a hot news director there, but he was very commercial, and he had a chip on his shoulder about public radio.
Oh.
One thing he tried to do was change the culture. He imposed a dress code. I mean, we had young women there who I don't think owned a dress. I know we had guys who didn't own a suit. I mean, we were young and didn't have any money.
Blue jeans.
We were making public radio dough.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, he imposed this kind of militaristic operating procedure we weren't used to.
And what went on the air sounded
just awful. So they fired all those people. They fired the producers, fired the hosts, who made out very well in television later. and drafted people from inside the building who knew how to put on a radio program and that public radio listeners would be used to. And I was one of the people they drafted. They said, just do it for 30 days.
Yeah,
and
right.
We'll get somebody else.
Yeah, we'll move you from ATC, where you were able to get up, 7 o'clock in the morning, something like that, to Morning Edition, where you got up at 1 a.m.
That's right. So do it for 30 days,
right.
And we'll get somebody else. And 24 and a half years later, they found him.
Bob, the extraordinary part was that I went on the air September of 79, knowing that you or somebody was coming to take 1 hour of my program, which was actually 3 hours to begin with.
We made your life easier.
It really did. It was wonderful. And Morning Edition, I must say, is absolutely a fabulous program. And you had a good time doing it, for the most part.
I did. I did at the beginning. NPR got very bureaucratic and took itself very seriously, and at the end it wasn't a lot of fun because there were 27 people in the building who could order me into a studio to change a word or something because the national desk didn't like this or the foreign desk didn't like this or the science desk didn't like this, and I just felt micromanaged. There were various people over there who wanted to impose pronunciation of syllables of words on me, and you can't do that to a broadcaster. It's one person at a microphone communicating with an audience, and they never got that. It's very top down now, where at the beginning it was bottom up. We had to come up with material for the program. Now it's top down, where you'll do this, you'll do that, you'll do this, you'll do it this way.
So when the end came, how did it come?
I was called into an office and said, this was like March 9th, 04. And so it was told April 30th will be your last show. And I said, but what about the anniversary? 25 years coming up in 6 months.
Right.
And I was told, the anniversary will be about the future, not about the past. Funny me, I always thought that anniversaries were by definition about the past, but never mind. Yeah.
What do you think happened?
I think they got tired of me and wanted somebody else. I think it's probably just as simple as that.
The story NPR put out was that they wanted you to have a co-host.
Oh, no, that was not the original. The first story was, we're meeting the changing needs of listeners. That was the press release material.
Okay.
And they got 50,000 emails of protests, so they had to think of something else.
Right.
So they lied. They said, we wanted two people in, and we wanted, and he didn't want a co-host. Well, they wanted two people in, but they didn't want me to be one of the two people.
They never asked you whether you wanted a co-host.
Never imposed one on me or ordered me to have one. If they had, I'd still be doing the program.
Because you would have enjoyed a co-host.
I would have preferred doing it alone, but, I had had one with Susan, and that was great.
Sure.
There was other stuff. There was, we want to bring in these people with great reporting skills. Well, they had just made me a reporter, so they're knocking my reporting skills. That's the kind of stuff that made me want to leave. When they started saying that sort of thing to the New York Times, I couldn't work for those people anymore. So I left.
So you left?
Yeah.
On your own?
Yeah. Yeah. I had like 20 offers right away as soon as this hit the papers.
Is that right?
Yeah, and this is the front page of the Washington Post. I couldn't believe I got fired on the front page of the Washington Post. And the phone started ringing. CNN, AP, I had two teaching offers. It was very flattering. I thought, I was 57 years old at the time. I wasn't sure I'd ever work again.
And XM, Sirius.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the... The CEO of XM was Hugh Pinheiro. He wrote me a letter and he said, maybe NPR doesn't want to hear you every day, but I do.
I love it.
When you get that on the worst day of your life, when you've been smeared in the New York Times, you say yes. And so I didn't even return the other calls.
Really?
Yeah, I went right to work for this guy.
There wasn't much time between leaving NPR and starting.
There was a book tour. I had a book coming out.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to leave until I had the book tour. So I went on the road for 3 months. I didn't have to be at the microphone anymore, so why not? And so I did, in effect, a victory lap of the NPR member stations, raised, I think, $1.2 million
wow.
in the process, because we always made it a benefit for the stations.
Of course.
And I was selling books, so I was happy. And it was great. I got to say goodbye to everyone.
And that was the book about Red Barber.
No, that was a book about Edward R. Murrow.
Ah, the first book was about Red Barber. And, of course, you were on here for both. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of folks waiting. I want to ask you, though, about the breakup of your marriage, which happened sort of in that same time period. What happened?
I think she got tired of me. Lost patience. I think she was always looking for the time back when we were on All Things Considered. When she married me, I was doing All Things Considered, and I was home in the evening and could go out and didn't have to worry about getting to bed early, had more family time. I was really married to my job. And when Morning Edition ended, I think she believed there would be a dividend for her. And it didn't happen. I think we had a little place out in Clark County, Virginia. And I think she thought I would go out there and commute. But it's an hour and a half into the city each day. And I know we just grew apart. The kids were grown, empty nest. And what can I say?
Well,
she fired me after 30 years, and so did NPR.
Well, I must say, I am delighted today to meet your fiancé.
Ah, yes. And who wouldn't be?
And congratulations to you on meeting and your pending marriage to Windsor Johnston, who is here in the studio today with us. Going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Fayette, Alabama. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning. Mr. Edwards, let me open by telling you what an honor it is to meet you. You sound a little bit like, for those of us growing up as children in the 70s, the announcer, although it sounded quite corny, on ABC's and Hanna-Barbera's revival of Super Friends in the late 70s. Perhaps you know his name. Perhaps you met him at some broadcasting industry convention someplace. I wish I knew. But anyway, here's a question that I have mainly about public radio itself that I've never gotten a chance to ask whenever a personality from public radio or PBS came on one of these talk shows. Not so long ago, last year, Talk of the Nation, Miss Suzanne Gladden was on. I think that's the name of the director at the time. And I should have asked her this question. Instead, I asked her about the possibility of a merger with PBS someday.
Okay, come on, let's have the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I thought about Morgan Freeman and Rita Moreno becoming the honorary chairpersons to get back at Sesame Workshop for the way it had mistreated their dignity in the 70s when we grew up watching them on the Electric Company. Here's my question. It's not about the recent controversies about public radio and whoever that journalist was who worked for another company.
Tell me what the question is.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's about fundraising and the choice of music on local stations.
What?
I know it's a decision by local stations.
Yes.
But there are too many people who don't know the positive benefits of public radio journalism, because I hear most of the local stations playing, at least down here in the Southeast, classical music, and yet they beg for money. Leonard Bernstein and Aaron Copland would want symphony orchestras and opera companies have the same problem.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there, Bob. Are you in charge of the music?
That was fascinating. The person should have his own show. That was great. No, I don't rule on the music, but
we'll have to talk to our own engineer, Toby Schreiner, about the music he chooses for the program. But in reality, it is up to each individual station. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now presenting a retrospective of Willem de Kooning, more at MoMA.org. By John and Catherine Debs, committed to advancing public understanding of America's energy needs and options. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org. A nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how one State Department employee spent time rebuilding Iraq.
We had money everywhere. It was literally in boxes that you had to step over. At one point in time, I had $100,000 in cash in a small safe in my office. I felt like a drug dealer.
Peter Van Buren's new book is We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Join us.
And here's an email for Bob Edwards from Gary in Florida, who says, in the late 1980s, I lost my job, then went through a divorce. One of the two things that helped hold me on during those darkest of days was looking forward to your Friday interviews with Red Barber. Thank you so much for the therapy and the interviews, as well as the great book you wrote about Red. Tell us about Red.
Oh, my gosh, that's great to hear.
That's lovely.
Yeah. We started Morning Edition, and it had designated segments, news segments, business segments, art segments, and a sports segment. And there was no tradition of sports in public radio.
Right.
We had no resources or knowledge to do that. So we filled the time with commentary. Frank DeFord was one of the original commentators, and he's still doing
Still doing it.
And Ketzel Levine was the sports producer. And she had interviewed Red about Jackie Robinson. Red Barber, pioneer sportscaster, was at the microphone in Brooklyn when Jackie Robinson joined the Dodgers and integrated baseball. And she'd interviewed Red about that and loved him, just loved him, and asked him if he'd be a commentator on Morning Edition. He said, yeah, but he wanted to read a script, write an essay or whatever, and read it. He wanted to have a conversation with the host of the program, and he wanted it live, which terrified me at the time, because it's a very scripted program. There's no spontaneity on there. I wasn't used to seat-of-the-pants radio. Well, I got used to it, thanks to Red.
Yeah, you bet, you bet.
And he's another one I went to school on, you know, just learning how to be a broadcaster from Red Barber. One week, he couldn't hear me. We lost the connection somehow. We could all hear him. He always spoke from his home in Tallahassee. We had a line into his house. And he understood right away that he could be heard. He says, I'm assuming that I can be heard. And he filled the 4 minutes by himself. And he had a stopwatch, so he knew when to wrap up. What a pro.
What a pro.
You learn from
indeed.
A guy like that.
Several tweets like this one from Elise, who says, hearing Bob Edwards' steady voice on 9/11 is something I will never forget. I miss him every morning. NPR made a big mistake. Talk about 9/11 and what happened.
I think people liked what we did because we were not able to show them the crashes again and again and again and assaulting their nerves and sensitivities and good tastes and everything else, as television did.
NPR was criticized because it did not make the announcement until late.
Yeah, Carl had it. Carl had it at the top of the hour at 9 o'clock. We did not break into programming until about 9:20. I remember interrupting. Susan was doing a recorded story. And it was, again, resources. We didn't have the resources then. They got them now. They're very attentive to breaking news now, and I think 9/11 probably changed that. And yet what we did won a Peabody Award. So, you know, I can't be ashamed of it. I went on the air when they told me to go on the air. But I think what we did, Our reporters in New York, WNYC, was very helpful that day because they were off the air. Their tower was on top of one of the World Trade Center towers.
Right.
And I learned that day that anyone with a cell phone is a reporter. We had everyday New Yorkers giving stunning word pictures of what they were seeing in Lower Manhattan,
which were even more vivid and dramatic than those we saw. Here's an email from Lynn in North Carolina, who says, during our 20-minute drive to school, I always had the local NPR station on radio. One day, about 3 weeks after Bob left Morning Edition, my 10-year-old son piped up, "Where's Bob Edwards?" Just so you know how far your influence went. And let's go to Clemson, South Carolina. Good morning, Abel.
Good morning, Diane. A wonderful show.
Thank you.
Bob, I grew up, I went to school at Florida State University. I used to listen to your interviews with Red Barber. And I've always been intrigued with radio announcers. My question is this, same question I asked years ago to Ed Bradley. If you could go back in time and pick anybody in history to sit down and have a one-hour interview with, who would it be and why?
Oh, I've got a long list. Thomas Jefferson, of course. I'd love to talk to Amelia Earhart. I have a crush on Amelia Earhart.
I like that.
Edna St. Vincent Millay. There's so many people, but Jefferson, I would just, open the mic and let him talk for an hour and find out what's going on in that very inventive mind, because he had so many interests in so many different fields.
And I think that goes right to our next caller. Jim is in Rockville, Maryland. Good morning to you. Jim, are you there?
Good morning. Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I want to thank Bob for teaching me a very important lesson. I'm a chaplain, and I teach other chaplains. And most people don't know how to ask a question. They ask way too many words. They use way too many words in their questions, like we heard earlier in the show.
Yeah, right.
And Bob Edwards has the best way to ask a question. Oh? taught me that, and I teach it to my students. That's a very, very effective way, and I want to thank Bob for all he has done for me and for my profession and for the spirit of public radio.
Yeah, another good one is, really?
That's it.
Well, that's a signal that, you know, this is very interesting and you should go on in that. You know, tell me more. It's the same as saying tell me more.
But you don't need a whole barrage of questions.
Right, and I'm a minimalist. I mean, the show, you know, especially Morning Edition, doing NPR News, it wasn't about me. It was about my guests. My guests were super, so I wanted to hear more of them. You know, I had enough ego satisfaction just to be hosting the program. That did it for me. I didn't need to talk.
Here's an email from Mac in Maryland who says, since your departure, Morning Edition has adopted a less formal presentational style. Hosts and reporters often chat, and the use of language has become less precise, more conversational. Bob, do you like this new style? It seems designed to engage the listener, but do you think it is more informative?
I read a piece in either the Columbia Journalism Review or American Journalism Review about on television. There is less video now. There's less reporting, more chatting. When news breaks, you don't have the reporter with the camera crew covering it. You call a bunch of people into the studio, sit them around, and chat about it. And why? Well, this is cheaper. It's a lot cheaper. I don't know why NPR would be doing that, because NPR has the resources to do serious journalism and always has. Always has done serious journalism. They haven't always had the resources, but they do now. And I don't know why they would go to the chatting.
Do you still listen to NPR?
I do.
What do you listen to?
I listen to Morning Edition. A lot of the public radio programs are on my channel on Sirius XM. Ira Glass.
Isn't he something?
Used to be my intern. Do you
really
believe that?
Really?
The guy is now producing Hollywood movies.
He's
working with Errol
Morris. Yeah. He is something. He's got quite an imagination.
I know. And he does a great show. I found a new way of telling stories. That's what we all do.
Yeah.
Just do it in different ways. And he found a new way.
Let's go to New Haven, Connecticut. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Good morning. I really, really appreciated Bob's presentations for so long. One of the things I most miss now, they still do, but nowhere near as well as Bob did, and that is at the half-hour mark of each morning show, he'd have some very humorous anecdote or some story he would tell. And I wondered how, Bob, you developed that and how, where you got your inspiration for doing those stories, because they were so fantastic. And like I said, they still do it, but nowhere near as well as you did.
I suspect what's happening is that somebody else is writing it for them, that the hosts are not writing it themselves. I don't know that to be true. It just sounds to me like they're not putting the effort into it that I did. I put probably too much effort into that and wasted a lot of time.
Tell me how you did it.
It was a 30-second thing, a kind of fluke in the format. What do we do in these 30 seconds? I don't know. What do you want to do in these 30 seconds? So I would do a kicker, just a little funny thing.
Zany.
In the news.
Yeah.
But I had some standards about it. I wanted it to be really good and write it well. It was 23 seconds of writing, by the way. So try to write something well in 23 seconds.
And where did you find your sources?
And people would call them in, and small-town newspapers and the like.
Do you remember any?
Oh, gosh. A lot of them were urban myths, you know. Stories that I actually got caught on one that was an urban myth. It was about someone in an ice cream store, and seeing a famous celebrity and putting the ice cream in a purse. You know, that's urban myth. But somebody wrote it up on, and it made the wires, and I bought it. And I'm ashamed of myself. But you know, it wasn't my fault, but I'm still ashamed.
You couldn't actually check these out.
No.
Yeah, yeah. All right, here's Deanna in Pompano Beach, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I'm wonderful, ecstatic. I would set my radio alarm to go off 5 minutes before you would identify yourself so that I could get the fog out of the head. You'd come on and you'd go, "This is Bob Edwards." I'd say, "Hi, Bob." And I could get up and start my day. I so miss that. What I would like to thank you for also is your Fridays with Red. I have such a great appreciation for baseball announcers because of what that man taught me through your interviews. And that has become my motto. The most important thing in baseball is listening to your announcers. And I just wanted to thank you for that.
Well, you're most welcome. Thank you for that.
Thanks for calling, Deanna. Tell me, and before I ask you, let me just remind our listeners, this is the Diane Rehm Show. Bob Edwards is here with me. His new book is titled A Life, A Voice in the Box, My Life in Radio. Tell me about your take on what happened to Juan Williams and how you believe it was similar to or different from what happened to you.
I think the only similarity is that it shows they still don't know how to fire somebody. you know, what they should have done with me is say, Bob, we're going to give you the show. You know, it's time for you to leave Morning Edition. Go out and do a victory lap around the membership of the stations.
Which you did anyhow.
Right. Yeah. And do the show, and it'll be really good for you. They didn't do that. With Juan, they should have said, look, it's causing us problems that you're over on Fox and saying outrageous things. Make a choice. Stay with us or go to Fox. You decide. And that's how they should have handled it. Instead, it was a miserable, sensational public thing. And you know, Vivian Schiller talking about his psychiatrist. I mean, the implication was that he's a crazy man. Well, he's not a crazy man at all. Yeah, and he's a good guy. So they just should have, you know, done it that way. And it was inevitable there was going to be conflict there, serving two masters.
But how come Mara Liasson's name is not raised in that same framework?
I guess she's not saying things about Muslim garb. I guess she's more measured in what she says, and it's not upsetting to them. I think it's a conflict. I think you should work for one or the other. If I were the news director, I would make them choose.
Is there ever any desire on your part to be back at NPR, given everything that's happened, given all the turmoil that NPR itself has gone through since you've left?
Well, I continue to be on public radio through PRI.
Absolutely.
And I'm very happy about that. I loved being part of the public radio family and my relationship with stations. Satellite radio has no stations. Where do I go to meet listeners? Need public radio.
But you got millions of listeners out there.
God bless them all. I would...
You don't have to fundraise.
Well, I do.
Except that you do for WAMU.
Well, yeah, if those
stations... Because you're here.
If those stations don't survive, they're not going to carry Bob Edwards Weekend. You bet. I pitch for them. I do promos for them. I will be in here at 3 o'clock on the Sunday that your pledge drive is going, and I am a day sponsor twice a year.
I'm glad.
That's important.
What do you think is the future of public radio?
I think you'd better find a way of replacing the federal dollar. I think the super committee is going to zero out all federal funds to public radio, and it's now about 7 to 15% of a station's budget, and doesn't sound like much, but to replace it.
Yeah.
It's enormous, and I worry because I want stations to thrive so they can carry my weekend show. And yeah, I think stations better get on that right now and find a way, a substitute for the federal dollar. They're, you know, it's not going to affect NPR except indirectly. NPR doesn't get a lot of money from the federal government, hardly any at all. But the stations pay dues to get the NPR programming, and they'll have less money with which to do that. So it's important to NPR, too.
Well, Bob Edwards, it's clear you are very important to all of our listeners. I'm glad to have you on the program to share the microphone with you. Congratulations on your program on Sirius XM. And congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. It's just always wonderful to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
A Voice in the Box, Bob Edwards.